My castaway this Christmas is a writer and comedian. As a child, she appeared to have no ambitions to become either funny or famous, and only achieved both after she met her equally well-known stage partner while they were training to be teachers. Together, they created a series of highly popular television comedy shows. But when her partner took a year off, my castaway decided to go it alone, writing and starring in a situation comedy that has become a BBC classic. She plays Edina, the champagne-swilling mother of a straight-laced daughter who, with her friend Patsy, equally bibulous and not averse to the odd snort of coke, make mayhem in the grand style. Most people find it absolutely fabulous. She is Jennifer Saunders. It's true, isn't it, Jennifer, that AbFab came about by default, really, back in, what was it, 92, because you performed without Dawn?
Yeah, I mean, we had both taken the year off. I mean, we both sort of decided that we loved doing French and Saunders, but, you know, we just needed some time to do other things. And the telephone didn't ring. The offers didn't pour in. And you sort of have to keep employed, so, you know, agent ringing you a lot saying, isn't there anything you can do, love? And eventually, I thought, well, I suppose I could write this character, because I knew the character quite well. And
why did you know the character well?
Because it was one of the sketches that Dawn and I did in French and Saunders, and I just felt that that character could go a bit further.
You're not telling me Dawn played Patsy?
No, Dawn played my daughter. She was obviously too old.
So it just developed, but it was the first time without Dawn, really, wasn't it, that you'd done anything professionally?
Yes, I mean, we'd worked with a group called Comic Strip and made some half-hour films, you know, in the early 80s. But yeah, it was the first time I'd done it.
On your own?
Yes, completely.
And it's been an incredible success. It's won BAFTAs and an Emmy and so on. You must have analysed why. Why do you think people get hooked on these two women who swill bolly and snort coke, as I say? Where, as they say in the business, are the points of reference?
It's kind of wish fulfillment. I think people would like to live like that. And I think we're quite strict on ourselves nowadays and what we allow ourselves to do and what we're told we should be doing, you know. How many units of alcohol, how many units of fat we're allowed to consume and all this stuff. And I think people would actually kind of have more pleasure if they lived more like Edina and Patsy.
What we really want to know, of course, is how much of Jennifer Saunders there is in Edina. I mean, is she the Mr. Hyde to your Dr. Jekyll?
In a way, I suppose she is. I mean, she didn't start out that way, but I think the more I had to write, the more I used my own experience and my own neurosis.
So
I think she has become more my mouthpiece in a way.
So you've been pretty slothful in your time, I understand, a bit like her.
Yeah.
You're a champagne drinker?
I used to be, actually, but I've been slightly spoiled. Because every interview we tend to do, or every photo session we do for the show, people just bring out loads of champagne. And you're always having to drink, not this morning, I noticed, Sue, but
what a refreshing change we are.
The corks aren't popping in here. But it has kind of ruined the thrill of champagne for me.
But you're a wonderful mother, I'm sure. How old are your daughters? Three of them?
Yep. The youngest one is 6, and the two older ones are 9 and 10.
You've really done it all in one go, haven't you? I mean, in the past 10 years, not only have you had all of this success, but you've also produced these three children. You must be exhausted.
It's a matter of becoming more organised, which I never was before. And I think the children force you to organise your life and sort yourself out a bit, really.
Tell me about your first record.
The first record is Moondance by Van Morrison. And I think I'd like to take it only because every time I hear it, it's a very happy song and it's a very upbeat song. And I think if there's one thing I would require, it's something to make me stand up and move.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance beneath the cover of October skies. You know the leaves on the trees are falling to the sound of the breezes that blow. You know I'm trying to please to the calling of your heartstrings that play soft and low. You know the night's magic seems to whisper and hush. You know the summer light seems to shine in your blaze. my love. Can I just make some more romance with you, my love? Well, I wanna make love to you tonight. I can't wait till the morning has come. Yet I know now the time is just right, and straight into my arms you will run. When you come, my heart will be waiting to make sure that you're never alone. There and then all my dreams will come true, dear. There and then I will make you my own. And every time I touch you, you just travel inside. Then I know how my love. Can I just make some more romance with you, my love?
Van Morrison and the title song from his album Moondance. I said that you and Dawn French, Jennifer, were training to be teachers in the very late 70s at the London Central School, was it?
Central School of Speech and Drama.
Were you really? I can't imagine either of you as a teacher.
Dawn definitely went there with the intent of becoming a teacher, and in fact was a teacher for a year. I went there slightly in error, actually. I had to go somewhere, and I thought I'd go there because it was in London. I wanted to come to London, definitely. And I thought, you need English. I had English, luckily. And I came along, and it was more of an audition you kind of did to get in. You know, you had to know if a note was up or down, and you had to put a leotard on and not look completely dreadful in it. Somehow, I don't know how, but somehow I got in. And I even pretended I'd seen a play, I think, too. The Rivals or something, which I never had. I think I'd only ever seen Charlie's Aunt in Worthing. I think that was my only theatre experience up to that moment.
But what about you and Dawn? Were you immediately attracted to each other, as it were?
Eventually attracting, yes. I mean, I think it was repelling at first. She was very, I don't want to say, because bubbly is completely the wrong word, but very outgoing and very sort of organised and popular, probably, and I think I was probably considered a bit laid back or sullen, or you know. And at first, I think there was not antagonism. I think there definitely was no meeting of the minds then.
But when was the moment then that you came together, as it were?
That was when we shared a flat together and realised that we made each other laugh.
And you started mucking about.
Yeah, just really just
making
to amuse.
Laugh.
Yes. I mean, it was a great time to kind of dress up because it was sort of tail end of punk. So we used to dress up as punks and think we could sit in the tube and frighten people and stuff. And we used to wear the most bizarre outfits.
And frighten people? I mean, you went out in
public. No, it was so unfrightening. We were tragically unpunk.
You became the menopause sisters.
Yeah,
they Who were they? What did they do, for heaven's sake?
Oh, they just pretended they could put safety pins through their ears and sung songs at parties. I knew about three chords on the guitar, and I think Dawn knew about two. And we used to sort of amuse people at parties.
At what point did you think, hang on, actually, you know, there's something more than just making our mates laugh in this?
That was probably about 10 years into our career, I think.
But seriously, so you
no,
never...
No, seriously, I don't think we ever... I think there was probably a moment about 6 years in when you suddenly stop and you go, this is now what I probably am going to do for the rest of my life, or this is how I'm going to earn my living.
But you didn't think that then.
Until then, it was a way of just sort of keeping going and having fun. And
but Dawn did go off and become a teacher.
Yeah,
she
was a teacher.
And you took to your bed.
I lived in a sort of shambolic house in Chelsea with a friend of mine. And, yeah, we used to just hang out, really, and do crosswords, and we did nothing for months on end.
But one day, the great turning point was you, was it not, seeing an advert in a paper?
I saw it, I think it was in the Stage, because we used to look at the adverts at the back of the Stage, and one day we saw an advert for the comic strip, it was a club in Soho.
Who did you do? What was the act?
Oh, we had two American women that we did, called Muriel and Diana, and I think they took us through the next 5 years, really. They were good acts.
Who were they? What did they do? What was
it? Oh, they were... I mean, it was at the time when the word muesli somehow was funny, you know. So anything alternative, that whole idea of alternative London, alternative culture, was just coming in, and people having therapy and all that kind of thing. So there, it was kind of therapy muesli-based act.
Record number two.
I think I'd like to take one kind of majorly sad thing for the time when you just think, oh, there isn't a boat coming, and you can just put it on and imagine that you might be about to die.
Part of the Lacrimosa from Mozart's Requiem, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic and State Opera Chorus, conducted by István Kertész. I am right in saying, aren't I, Jennifer Saunders, that your becoming a comedy actor and writer was completely unpredictable. I mean, there's nothing in your background, your childhood, no performers in the family.
No, there's no... I think there are any performers. There's no
nothing in your school life that might have hinted at it. Did you do school productions?
Hockey.
You were a horse, I understand. In the sense that, you know, like young teenage girls can be, just mad on horses. That's what
I was mad on horses. Oh, completely. No, I was absolutely pony mad.
You were Lucinda Pryor Palmer, were you?
I would have liked to have been. That was my big ambition, actually, was to become a three-day eventer, and to win badminton three-day event was my biggest ambition. Until, really, I was probably about 16 or 17, it was my biggest ambition. I think I got my first pony when we were in Wiltshire, and I had a friend who had a farm. And I think I persuaded my parents that if I didn't go away to school, which is my perception of it, probably not theirs, that if I wasn't sent away to school, then, you know, they could probably afford to buy me a pony. And I got a pony when I was about 11, I think.
And went to the local comp?
Yeah.
What would the school reports have said about you? How would they have described you?
I don't think anything was too bad. I think generally it was a kind of apathy thing. It was a could-try-harder comment on most things.
A bit sullen?
Possibly, yes.
But it is interesting, isn't it, that I mean, a lot of shyness, as you say, is all bound up in them. People who are unforthcoming in that way are usually just terrified, basically.
I think it was a time when I was very shy, but generally, I think, I mean, even if I look at photographs, I think I probably was actually just quite sullen.
Lazy, sullen.
Well,
attractive character we've
very
got.
Attractive. I was very happy in my head, I have to say, so I think I lived a lot in, you know, in my head.
But nevertheless, strange that you should end up performing on the stage. And there are different descriptions of you as being, having stage fright, and also being too relaxed on the stage. I mean, which is it?
I have been too relaxed, I know that. I have had that problem, which is when you lose concentration a lot and you can't afford to do that.
It's an unusual problem,
actually. It happened when I was in a play with Dawn. I do remember becoming too relaxed. And actually, there was a moment when I had a prop, which was a magazine I could read. It was about guns and shooting and things. And I remember one time when I actually started to read the magazine and get really into the magazine, and I just couldn't think where we were in the play.
Record number three.
This is Blondie. It's from a period when, you know, London just felt great, and you were kind of young and you just didn't care. You had nothing to care about, no property, no nothing. Didn't care.
You got it in your pants and on.
Blondie and I Didn't Have the Nerve to Say No from their album Plastic Letters and Memories of a Misspent Youth, Jennifer, yeah?
Yes, great. I love it.
Aerial bending time, you said.
Well, kind of strutting down the street time.
Back at the comic strip and the comedy store, which is the beginning of when you stop bending aerials or whatever you do. Raymond's Review Bar as well.
CD Soho.
That was the early 80s. What kind of stuff were you doing by then on stage?
Dawn and I used to get props. We used to find a prop and find something funny to do with it. It was kind of fairly basic stuff.
And how did it go down in the comic strip?
Well, I think okay. I mean, initially we were only on, like, I think midweek nights, which could be very poorly attended, luckily. So we embarrassed ourselves initially in front of very few people. And I think our act got better. Initially, you see, we were under the illusion that we had to change our act every night. Because we thought, well, people have seen it now. You know, there might only be 10 of them, but they've seen it. And we thought we had to think up something new. So the material will thin very, very quickly. And then we developed the French and Saunders persona.
Did you call it?
Because otherwise
that
all you
then?
Do is you bow and wait for people to realise that's the end. And then that sound is heard. Otherwise, you don't know how to end a sketch, you see. And so we had to develop something that could link the sketches, and that's how French and Saunders developed, really.
But did you call yourselves that then?
No, it was Alexis Sale who made that up. We were thinking of other names, you know. The other acts were The Outer Limits and 20th Century Coyote, and we thought, oh, we can't just have our names. We were thinking things like Kitchen Tiles and
Great,
Big and Little, or Big and Big, or something. Anything with in the middle seemed to be good at that time. And then I think probably Lexi just lost patience and just called us French and Saunders, and that was it then.
And in the next dressing room in one of these places was a sort of sweaty bunch, I think, called...
Sweaty hairy bunch.
Ben Elton, Rick Mayall.
Honestly, they performed in a hot theatre night after night, and they never cleaned their suits.
Did they wash?
I'm not sure. It was fairly heaving in there.
But you ended up marrying one of them, Ade Edmondson, who was, of course, eventually in The Young Ones.
Yeah.
Did you spot him immediately? You thought that sweaty, smelly one?
No, it was a 5-year slow burn. And, you know, one thing led to another.
Record number four.
Record number four is Janis Joplin singing Cry Baby. I adore Janis Joplin, and I think there could be no more perfect situation than being completely alone so I could do my Janis Joplin impression on a rock looking out to sea.
I know she
Janis Joplin and Cry Baby. The BBC took a gamble on French and Saunders in the mid-80s, didn't it? And it eventually paid off, but it was a slow starter.
It was a very slow starter.
Effectively, therefore, you learned your trade on the hoof, on the job.
I think you have to. I mean, I think it's harder nowadays to. The whole nature of television means that people tend to judge quicker and take less risks, and I think... But if something isn't an immediate success, then the chances of it getting a second series are probably slimmer than they were. It's not impossible, but
it was always the BBC's great strength, wasn't it?
Great strength.
That it was prepared to live with perhaps a couple of series that didn't take off, believing
our first series
it eventually
was,
would.
It wasn't great. And Dawn and I look back on it and we're quite embarrassed. But we were very cocky then, and you know, you did go into it thinking, oh, we know how to do television, we've watched television. We know what to do, and we made some very big errors. We were lucky that there was a time when the BBC did invest in us and did trust that we might make it eventually.
Do you get the feeling you just squeezed in before they shut the doors?
We did leap through that little loophole, I think, yeah. And it closed behind us.
Next record.
The next record is the prelude to Parsifal. But I must say I'm not a fan of Parsifal, the whole of Parsifal. I kind of cut off when the singing starts and the big people come on.
Part of the prelude to Wagner's Parsifal, played by the Concert Orchestra of Amsterdam, conducted by Bernard Haitink. So you and Dawn, as you say, are safely on the inside, mm-hmm. and you signed a contract, a five-year contract, back in 93, I think, for zillions of pounds.
Well, not true.
They always say that.
They always say that. We didn't... we didn't get paid. It was actually from our... We wanted the security, actually, of knowing that we had somewhere to put programmes for 5 years, you know.
To do what you like,
to experiment. We initiated the thing. No, just literally for security reasons, because, you know, for safety.
But what I understand is that you could, you know, do another series of Absolutely Fabulous if you felt you could write another one, or you could do another series of French and Saunders, or not, or do something else. It left you kind of free. You were married to the BBC, as it were, but within that marriage you could move around a bit.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Which is quite nice. Yeah. It's writing, it's being a writer as opposed to a performer that gives you that strength, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, that is a huge advantage. I think without that you're in the market, you know.
Mm. You just have to do what you're told if you're just a performer.
Yeah, audition madly.
And, how do you and Dawn do it, right? Like, apparently you shut yourselves in a room together and nobody else is allowed in because you'd all be too embarrassed.
Writing, I mean, if you're writing as a double act, it is kind of embarrassing sometimes because you have to make up characters and make up things that aren't particularly funny, and you have to become other people. And if you have a good relationship with the person you're working, that's fine. It's not embarrassing, but... I wouldn't do it in front of strangers.
So
it's not funny at all.
But Dawn obviously seems to be the secret in all this. You know, she's a bit of a catalyst, isn't she?
It's very different writing on your own to writing a sketch show or you know, doing characters with Dawn. It's the best fun to sit in a room with someone and just make each other laugh. It's great.
As long as you continue to like each other, which you do.
Yeah.
What about Joanna Lumley on Absolutely Fabulous? Is she any kind of cat? I know she doesn't write it with you, but you know, is there a kind of creative input there too?
Oh yes, I mean for everyone who's in the show, and Joanna particularly. I mean, she's sort of invented Patsy in a way. I mean, I wrote the lines, but that character came from her, really.
But when you're recording it, I understand, you stay in character the whole time, don't you? You don't sort of...
Oh, we mess about a lot. I mean, it's not strictly in character.
But are you messing about to amuse the studio audience?
Yes,
or
absolutely.
Or because... Oh, really?
Yeah, to amuse the studio audience.
It's not because you personally need to stay in character.
I tell you, no, not at all. It takes a lot to keep me in character. I have a sort of shallow level of concentration.
Have you worked on that, or don't you think...
It's come by doing comedy, I think. I don't think I'd be very good at doing anything particularly serious now. Because for so long, all you've been doing is trying to find the funny possibilities in something, and the funny possibilities in being very serious are, you know...
Not great. Record number six.
Record number six is A Case of You by Joni Mitchell. I sort of came to Joni Mitchell late. I think I was put off initially. She just looked like a kind of skinny sixth former with a guitar, which is a sort of nightmare. And now I listen to her an awful lot.
Just before our love got lost, you said, I am as constant as a northern star. And I said, constant in the darkness, where's that at? If you want me, I'll be in the bar. On the back of a cartoon coaster, in a blue TV screen light, I drew a map of Canada. Oh, Canada. With your face sketched on it twice. I would still be on my feet. Oh, you're in my blood like holy wine. It's so bitter. So sweet.
Joni Mitchell and A Case of You from her Blue album. So Absolutely Fabulous is absolutely over, is it? No more Say
Yes.
Or Never Say Never.
No, I think I am saying never.
This time?
Mm.
You said it before.
I did, but then I hadn't ruled out the possibility of maybe doing a film. But that didn't work out, so it became a TV special. But there's no more life in it.
Okay. And French and Saunders as a series is finished, but you do one-off specials.
I think that's what we'll do, is specials.
So what are you going to do with your life now you're so rich and famous and successful? And you have to play Lady Macbeth, I think.
I'm just going to live in bubble bath. I'd really like to write a film, I think, because it's a sort of next stage on, a sort of challenge. And I'd quite like to direct, really.
Oh, would you?
Total control freak.
You don't strike me as the sort of person who likes telling other people what to do.
I'm very good at it, I assure you.
Are you?
Yes. I can be very bossy.
How much do you fear the critics? Because you do, you know, people like you and Dawn get into a kind of no-win situation, don't you, where you've been so successful now for so long that they're just waiting for you to fall.
Yes, they are. And, I mean, I don't like bad criticism, you know. I find it quite hard to take, and it makes me very cross.
But does fear of the critics, you know, stultify your creative what's-it, as it were?
It's not fear of it. It's the anger that it makes you feel if you've had a bad review or something. A non-constructively bad review.
Mm.
And it's that anger which makes you then, the next thing you write, you're writing out of a feeling that you want to get back at them and show them you can do it and all the rest of it.
Is that not a good thing?
No, it's really not good. But I can't do it from that.
Record number 7.
One of my favourite singers of all time is Elvis Costello. And I've listened to him right from, you know, when I was at college up until now. And I think he's just terrific.
Sweet hair. Sweet hair. Don't you say that love would never dare. I'll always be there. In the hour of your distress, you need not fear. In all the world is known one true love. And finding it harder now. And bless whatever's in the on the precipice above the abyss, and though the touch of your lips is ceaseless, make no mistake, there is an ache I have to live with. What's my grip to lose? My grip too strong.
Elvis Costello and Sweet Pear from his album Mighty Like a Rose. Now, Jennifer, we normally prepare to cast you loose on the water at this stage, but as it's you and as it's Christmas, tell me instead, what will you and your family be doing?
Aid will be cooking.
He does the
Aid will become Delia Smith.
I thought you might metamorphose into her,
you
know.
I'm not the cook, you see. Aid's the cook.
Really?
And he'll do the Christmas, and is excellent at it, which is great, a great relief for me.
Do you do anything at Christmas?
Yes, no, I make fires. I'm sort of log woman and fire woman. And I do decorations. I do the sort of decorating side. Mm. Does the cooking side.
And the children?
Oh, the children have a great time. They decorate the tree and hoop that they haven't just got a rotten tomato and a piece of string, which is what I told them when I bought them for Christmas.
But you love your garden, which owes a lot to Vita Sackville West. Is this true?
Yes. I mean, I've adore gardening now, which I never thought I would, because my parents used to love gardening, and as a teenager, to be, you know, woken up at 10 o'clock in the morning by the sound of a wheelbarrow clanking up and down. And I thought, oh, I'm never going to get into gardening. And I completely have. I absolutely love it.
Tell me about your last record.
Last record is Emmylou Harris. I have a great love for country music, or a lot of country music, or a lot of old-fashioned country music, generally. And I actually met Emmylou Harris. I was completely starstruck.
Emmylou Harris and Amarillo. Now, if you could only take one of those eight records, Jennifer, which one would it be?
I have to say, I think it probably would be the Blondie, I think.
Would it?
Yes.
The Shouting in the Streets,
yes. Because I...
Hanker after your lost youth.
No, huh? I find it very easy to just sit. And it is a record that could might inspire me to actually get up and walk and do something.
What about your book?
The book would be Freya Stark's Traveller's Prelude. She's a great heroine of mine. And in the book is the great descriptions of my two favourite places, which are Devon and Italy.
And your luxury?
My luxury would be The Tribute Heads by Elizabeth Frink, which are sort of four massive head sculptures, really. And the reason I thought I'd take them was not just because I have an audience and someone to talk to, but I think because I can very easily just sit and do nothing, and there might just be a moment when you just lose it and you just want to flap about in the sand like a stranded fish. And I think they have, there's a great dignity in them and a great sort of strength. I think they might sort of inspire me to sort of remain sane.
Jennifer Saunders, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs, and happy Christmas.
And to you.